Welcome to the All of a Kind podcast. I'm Batya Wittenberg.
I'm Miroff Hoffman.
We loved these books when we were kids. We love them now, and we hope you do too.
Today's chapter is the one where the girls buy Papa a birthday present.
Okay, so this is a shortish chapter, but there's lots of fun stuff in it. Basic summary of what happens. Ella calls a secret meeting after bedtime to plot a birthday surprise for Papa. The girls gather and pool their pennies and try to find the perfect birthday present. But will Papa like their gift? They have to wait until dinner to find out.
This is a really short chapter, and it's interesting because it precedes what I think of as a very long chapter, which is the Purim chapter, and we're going to get to that next episode. But this is really kind of like a little bit of a prelude. It kind of gives us a glimpse of December, and then we get into, you know, the world of Purim, which is actually significantly after this. So we do get kind of a time gap after this chapter. This chapter dates for the week before January 5th, which is Papa's birthday.
Yes, and I think, I'm not sure, but I think this is the first actual date we've had since Dusting is Fun, which was November.
Yes, so now we've had about a month's worth of, you know, things going on in the family.
About 2 months worth.
And now we're up to a significant date, which is Papa's birthday. I noticed there's not a Mama's birthday chapter.
You know, you're right.
Probably because it would have been too repetitive. Yeah.
But like not in this book and not in later books either, I don't think.
Right. And that's just sort of interesting to me is like what is the gender balance of realizing that, oh, well, Papa has a birthday. Possibly it's because Papa is out of the house more and this is an immediate way of showing affection. Whereas Mama is always there to receive affection, whether or not Mama is there to receive affection emotionally.
I getcha. Yeah. It could be that. It could also just be that because, again, these are dramatized memories. It could be just that adult Sydney had this particularly vivid memory of the time we bought that one thing for Papa's birthday. And otherwise, the parental birthdays just don't have the same kind of memory weight of what happened this year, what happened this other year. I know that we got presents and did special things for my parents' birthdays when we were kids, but I cannot recall a single one of them specifically. I just know it was a thing that happened.
Yeah, I agree. We bought presents. I think we used to get my dad an umbrella practically every year, but it's hard to buy for my dad. Telescopes are not in a child budget, but ultimately there is no year that specifically sticks out. So I think you're right that this is a callback to something that really happened. And it actually matches up with what we know about the time frame, because there was a cup and saucer craze. And in fact, both my maternal and my paternal grandmother collected what I would call unique cups and saucers, where each cup and saucer was itself of the same pattern. So the cup and the saucer would both be bright pink roses. And then every other saucer and cup in the collection would be different from it.
Yeah, so like if you were bringing out all of the cups and saucers for, say, a tea party, which I cannot see Mama hosting a tea party. That doesn't seem to be her vibe at all. But nonetheless, if one were to host a tea party and would bring out all the pretty collectible cups and saucers, everybody would have a matched set and nobody's would be like anybody else's. And that I think that was on purpose. I think the point of that was like you could admire each other's and compare them and the spread would be in itself a conversation piece.
Exactly. And it's sort of, you know, like collectible trading cards, you know, oh, I've got two of this one. Rose, do you want to trade for mine? That kind of thing.
Oh, aha. I wonder if they did that.
I don't know, but it is a really interesting idea because so few of these things are aimed at women. And I think that it's interesting that this fad existed in this period, probably because women had a little bit more spending money because they were working in factories.
Very likely.
And so creating a market for things that women would want to buy was something that the China manufacturers were like, hey, this is taking off. We're selling single set cup and saucers as opposed to an entire set for tea.
Oh, that's right. Because another advantage of that for a poorer family would be you don't have to buy them all at once. And it's not just okay, but a selling point that they don't all match.
Right. You accumulate your collection over time.
Mm-hmm. And so you only need, as we know from the Samuel Vimes Boots theory of socioeconomics, look it up, folks, the wealthy can afford a big chunk of money at one time, whereas the poor can afford small chunks of money over a much longer period of time. makes a difference. $50 over 5 months is not the same thing as $50 at once.
Exactly. And in fact, Papa's thoughts at the end of the chapter really
Oh,
echo
yeah.
that.
Oh,
We
yeah.
get Papa's interiority in this chapter. Hey, Batya, you know what time it is?
Hey, that's right.
It's time for what's on the page.
And what's not on the page?
So for the first time in this chapter, we get an actual interior thought from Papa. And it's because in this, scenario that's played out, the girls have saved their money and they've bought this cup for Papa. We get to actually see what Papa is thinking. And it's exactly what you were talking about,
Which is not what he
which is
says.
not what he says, which I think we'll get into a little bit later. But like, he absolutely is thinking about that same theory of economy. And
Yes.
let's just kind of talk about how that came about before we get ahead of ourselves. So Ella calls a secret meeting, and I think this is really interesting that it's called out as being a secret meeting because the girls actually have a tremendous amount of freedom after bed, right? They're not usually moving about from bed to bed.
That was talked about earlier, that once the door is closed, Mama does not generally check on them. She's okay if they stay up talking or whatever. Says they're resting their bodies anyway. Which chapter was that in? That was a really early one.
It's very early. So we basically have this concept baked into the world. And beyond that, we now have this idea. It's really cold. Like, it's been emphasized a couple of times that getting out of bed is an experience in being very cold, like possibly freezing. And they're all piling into one bed, which does generate some heat, but there's actually friction between the sisters
Yes.
because Hanny decides that she's going to lie down. Right? The paragraph says it like something like that, all the five wiggling girls go up against the one wall with their pillows.
Yes. And Charlotte says, "Stop humping up your knees. You're letting all the cold air
Right, because
in."
Henny is lying down and sticking her knees up so that her feet are under the cover.
Ella's the one who calls that out.
Right.
That, like, well, Ella's toes don't stick out. That's because I'm sitting up and Henny is lying down. You stop trying to be so comfortable and sit up like the rest of us.
Which is funny because I don't know about you, but if I was sitting in bed with my sisters and I was lying down and they were sitting up, I would feel like they were kind of like looming over me and I wouldn't be comfortable at all. Whereas Henny is like, I'm going to be indolent and lie in the bed. And all y'all can sit up.
This is such a recurring thing about Henny that I genuinely love. It's going to sound like I'm being either sarcastic or ironic, but no, I actually love this. Henny is selfish.
Yes. And it's painted very clearly.
Henny is also generous and giving and loving, but Henny is selfish in a way that a lot of the other girls don't let themselves be because they wouldn't feel good about themselves if they were. And Henny is like, nah, I'm gonna lie down and be lazy 'cause I want to. And only when that gets called out, like, no, that is why you are having the problem of your feet being cold. If you sat up, your feet wouldn't be cold. Ah, fine.
Yeah, I think it's actually interesting because quite a lot later we see Henny being very industrious,
Oh, yeah.
right? Because anytime Henny is challenged, she will 100% rise to the challenge and do the
Oh,
thing.
yeah.
But it's only when Henny is challenged. And it's interesting, like the pattern that is being established with Henny in book one, which is sort of this like, oh no candy for an entire week. Because when Ella makes her proposal that all the girls save their pennies, right? Henny's like, I can't buy myself anything for a week. And that does really sort of focus the attention of the reader on Henny's selfishness, right? Henny wants to lie down. Henny wants to spend her money on herself. Now, these are not things that are normally selfish. Like, this is lying down time.
Right.
Henny is doing what she would normally do at this hour, which is lying down in her own bed. She doesn't have to share a bed with people. So if she wants to hump her knees up,
She doesn't affect anybody else.
right, she doesn't have to share. She doesn't have to think about it. Right. So Charlotte's like, wait a minute, this is not okay. And Henny is like, wait, well, why isn't this? Oh, I guess it's oh, fine, I'll sit up. So I thought this was really an interesting point, given that we just had the Sabbath chapter. The girls are accumulating their pennies, right? They make this plan in bed. They're like, we're going to not tell mama, which is already a whole thing. We're not going to tell our parents that we're doing this. It's a
Just got to
surprise.
feel just deliciously wicked. We have a secret. We have a
Right.
secret.
Like, ooh, we're going to do a thing. We're rubbing our hands together.
Which is also, just to jump back a little bit, this is also part of the fun of Charlotte and Gertie's game with the candy, is we're
Yes,
having this
exactly.
delightful secret thing that nobody knows about. Mama knows.
Of course she knows.
Mama is fully aware, but so long as they don't know Mama knows, that is a big part of the fun. And I think keeping it
Well,
secret.
it's also called out as wriggling and giggling.
Yes.
And I would assume that these beds
Oh,
creak.
probably.
And so Mama probably knows that wriggling and giggling is going on. And, she's not coming in to check on them. She trusts her girls, right? They're getting up to something. She knows Papa's birthday is coming. She probably doesn't immediately assume that that's what's going on, but she is, if this is within the remit of things that are permissible.
Exactly, yeah. She trusts that if her girls are up to something, it's something that she wouldn't disapprove of. It's something that she doesn't have to worry about.
Exactly. And so long as no shrieking is going on, everything stays in the bedroom.
Yeah.
So now we have, again, sort of the economy of the family pennies. Sarah has the ongoing commitment to the library. So when Ella says, everybody give your penny, Sarah has to actually bring up, what about the library? She actually has to bring it up with her sisters. And she kind of gets poo-pooed, right? Like one of the sisters is like, oh, well, can't we skip a week? Aren't we done paying for that old book yet, says Henny, which is a line that has stayed with me, because it's only been a few months. But because it's basically a tax on their
It
income,
is. It
right?
is.
Henny is
And
ready to be done.
also, I mean, when you are, how old is Henny? 10? When you are 10, a few months is forever.
It is forever. It's a lot longer emotionally. And so, 8-year-old Sarah is incredibly responsible because she does feel like, maybe they're still going to revoke my library privileges. Maybe they're still going to send me to prison, right? Like she's got that, to call back to the first episode.
She doesn't say, but we could lose library privilege. She says, but I promised.
I
She
promise.
takes her promises
And
seriously.
I think that this is really one of the things I really see probably Sydney Taylor's editor doing here is keeping the library lady on the page and keeping Charlie on the page. Like in this chapter, both Miss Allen and Charlie get
They're
invoked,
both invoked, yeah.
even though they're not there. And we'll see Charlie again in the next chapter, but when they are invoked, it's calling to mind that these characters exist, even though they're not in the
We don't
chapter.
want to forget about them, yeah.
Right. Make sure that you keep Miss Allen in mind. And it's also continuity, right? Like this is where Sarah's life is right now. Her interiority is partially consumed by this debt that she owes to society and to the library, and that hangs over her relationship with Miss Allen, right? Like she doesn't want to cheapen that relationship by being a debtor. So she's definitely thinking about it.
So now she has two commitments going in two different directions, or rather, one commitment that she's bringing up because of the prospect of making another commitment of we're all going to pool our pennies this week. And what she does, I love this so much. She says, all right, I have a third commitment, which is just to myself, which is she's saving up for a doll.
Yes.
She says, I've got a lot saved up. I'm just going to take 5 pennies out of that because that is a way that she can use money that doesn't let anyone else down.
Exactly. And I think that that's not only the maturity of Sarah, but also the realization that holding her sisters to this commitment will make it less fun for Papa and less fun for the rest of them. So she is taking it on herself to take that burden which her siblings have taken, and redistribute it onto herself for 1 week.
Yeah. Yeah, and she doesn't say, well, our Friday pennies are already spoken for. We'll just have to get Papa a present for 5 cents less. She doesn't say that. That doesn't occur to her.
No, and it's really interesting because it's so Jewish,
Yeah.
right? Like the idea of lessening your own joy while something else joyous is going on. Like when we're at a wedding, the groom breaks a glass in remembrance of bad things that have happened to the Jews, specifically the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And in this case, Sarah is saying, and this is a very small example, I will take away from my own joy in drops, sort of like when we're at the Seder, there's a part of the
Like
Seder
pouring out of the wine,
where you pour
yeah.
out wine for the things that happened to the Egyptians because they're people and we care about them.
Just in case anybody doesn't know about this, because the phrasing is ambiguous, this is pour out, not in the sense of pour into cups, but pour out of our cups, spill out wine that we then don't drink.
Right. In my family, we use our fingers and we put like the clean pinky finger into the cup and take out 10 drops. And then there are other traditions where you do different things with actually
Some people
pouring.
actually pour out of the cup, some use a spoon to dip out certain amounts. But yes, we lessen our own joy, as you say.
And this is why white tablecloths at Seders are a bad idea.
Yes.
But Sarah is doing that exact thing. She is basically, I mean, maybe subconsciously, but doing this very standard Jewish thing of like, all right, well, I won't get my doll as soon, but Papa will be happy.
Yes.
I'm taking away from my own joy and I'm giving that portion of my joy to my father. And what could be better than that? What's really interesting to me is the allocation of the pennies. So I came up with this while I was reading because we get a call out very shortly after the scene goes on. The girls vow that they're going to give all their pennies to Ella. We finally find out that pennies officially are distributed at lunchtime by Mama. And that's really interesting to me. I had always sort of assumed that they were given out in the morning. I don't know where I formed that opinion. It probably is just that lunch is the end of the morning, and I read these books when I was little, and I just assigned them to a specific time frame. But they get their pennies, they turn them immediately over to Ella so that they're not tempted to carelessly spend them. Ella keeps them in a pill box, which is described as like overflowing with 35 cents. And I got to that number, 35 cents, and went, wait, that doesn't work. Why do they have 35 cents?
Well, there's five girls and
Right.
7 days for the week. That should be 35, right?
It's 35 cents. But being from a Jewish background, I immediately assumed that days of the week were either 6 days, not including the Sabbath, which we just talked about in the last chapter, right? No handling money on the Sabbath,
No
or
handling
just
money.
the days of the week, Monday to Friday, work days, right? Like if you're getting allowance and you're getting it for doing chores, which is not a direct correlation in the books, right? It's not, if you don't do your chores, you don't get your penny. We talked earlier in a different episode about the social contract. They're getting a penny a day. So we don't ever actually get clarity on whether a penny is given out on the Sabbath or whether they just get 2 pennies on Sunday to make up for the fact that they don't get a penny on the Sabbath or what.
Well, it's not 2 pennies on Friday, which is what I would have guessed, one for today and one for tomorrow, because we know they get 1 penny on Fridays. That's the one they give to the library lady.
Right, exactly. And I mean, I think also that that would sort of be rewarding ahead, which is sort of against the social contract that they have.
Whereas 2 on Sunday would make sense.
It would make sense.
But yeah, that honestly hadn't occurred to me that it should be 25 cents for just work days. Or 20 or 30 cents, I can math, 30 cents counting Sunday, but it's 35 cents, which suggests that there is a penny for Sabbath.
So that's just kind of interesting to me. As someone who grew up not handling money on the Sabbath,
Same.
it just occurs to me that like that's not a thing, right? Of course you weren't getting a penny for something you did on the Sabbath. But then I thought about the allowance system I had as a kid, and I realized that in fact, even though I wasn't being paid for things done on the Sabbath, I still got accumulated tasks if I did them on the Sabbath. Like, put your laundry in the laundry basket was a 5 cent task. Did I do it on the Sabbath? Yes, I did. So when I did the tally at the end of the week, did I check the box for Saturday? I did. So technically, I was getting paid for things done on the Sabbath, but my dad is also a rabbi. And technically, he gets paid for things he does on the Sabbath too. But in reality, the money is allocated around that so that you're not technically being paid for Sabbath work.
Exactly. Yeah. I once had my sister and I once had a quote unquote job, very off the books thing when we were teenagers of running groups for the little kids during Sabbath prayers at our shul, at our synagogue. And I asked about that, like, how is it that we can get paid for something we do on Shabbat? Isn't that straight up not allowed? And they said, well, there is basically a legal fiction that says what you are getting paid for is the preparation that you do ahead of time
Correct.
and any sort of work you have to do afterwards, after Shabbos, like suppose you have a bag of books you bring at some point, you have to unpack that bag of books. Anything that you do preparatory or afterwards, that is, even if it's not very much, that is the part you're getting paid for. The part that you're doing actually on the Sabbath
Is volunteer labor.
is considered that it's volunteer. And it's hair splitting, but vast amounts of Jewish halacha are based on very, very fine detail like that.
And
So
Batya, tell our readers what halacha is.
halacha, sorry, thank you. Halacha is a Hebrew word that literally it's based on the word holech that means to go or to walk. So you could say it literally means the way. Yes, that makes it a precise analog to the Tao. I learned that in college and was delighted by it.
Or the way from The Mandalorian.
I have seen people say this is the way talking about halacha. That delights me. What it refers to is practice of Jewish law, of Jewish religious law, in all of its manifold, very, very widespread ways. And interpretation of halakha varies wildly across time and space. So when we talk about things like at the end of the last chapter, it was the last chapter, wasn't it? The Sabbath, mm-hmm. where it says no light could be struck on the Sabbath. That was the law. You might also say that's the halakha.
Exactly.
So that's what that means.
All I can say to that is you got paid. I ran a junior congregation for years. We didn't get paid. I guess my supervisor probably got paid, but I did not. I was volunteer labor, and I think I was given a nice book at the end of my junior congregation career.
Oh, but that's nice.
Yeah, but it was given to me by my supervisor out of his own budget.
Yes, I think we got something like $5 or $10 each a week.
That's luxury.
It was not even what would have gone for standard babysitting rates in that decade.
Definitely not. I was a babysitter in those days.
But they didn't want us to stop doing it.
That's really fair. I mean, it's a really critical service. And I mean, this doesn't get brought up in the books, but because the children are not regular synagogue goers, which we're going to see in the next chapter, synagogue is kind of a, you know, holidays and special events thing for the children in these books. But Batya and I grew up in congregations where children were included. And as a result, the adults would be in a 3 or 4 hour long service. And the children, the smaller children, would get bored, right? And they would fidget or cry. And so there were frequently these services where people would bring their kids to some older kids. And the older kids would either, and in the case of what we were doing, we would actually run a miniature service, complete with a Torah reading, and, you know, teach the kids the prayers so that when they were, you know, in Hebrew school or in synagogue, they would understand what was going on. Show them where they were in the prayer book and figure out like, hey, this is the English, this is the Hebrew, this is what we're doing, and explain all that stuff. But also there were like what we would call story groups. And story group was literally where you would have a couple of teenagers or a couple of adults reading stories to children and just try to keep them in a, you know, an engaged frame of mind on Jewish themes.
We would also do storytelling. We would play games with them. It was primarily keep them occupied when they need to leave the room where the actual services are going on, and keep them from making too much noise right outside the room where the services
exactly.
were going on.
And critically, keep the blood sugar up.
And critically, yes, snacks. Snacks were crucial.
Snacks are crucial. We did a whole formalized service where we actually, you know, did the entire service. And then we had a collation at the end, like what we call a kiddush, which is just, you know, snacks and a little bit of grape juice to symbolize wine. And little bread rolls to symbolize, you know, blessing the bread and all of that stuff, so that the kids would also learn this blessing.
That is really nice. The big difference, I think, between that the period that this family is growing up in and the period that we grew up in is less are kids included and more are the women going to shul.
Exactly.
It is when the women go to synagogue that problem arises. Who is going to be watching the kids while the women pray? Because before that, it's the men pray, the women watch the kids.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it does get called out in the next chapter that women are infrequent visitors to the synagogue. Mm-hmm. And so we probably have ritual visitation, like if somebody's parent were to die, that it's possible.
Oh, well, of course, yes.
Well, not necessarily, of course.
No?
In many cases in this era, saying the prayer for the dead was allocated to the nearest male relative. So if mama's mother was to die, I don't know the status of mama's mother at this point, papa might have been the one to say Kaddish as the son-in-law.
Or Hyman, mama's
brother.
Or
Hyman would say it, right. So it would, the obligation would not fall on all of the children, it would fall on the male children. And so that's another thing that we take for granted today, is that women will always say the prayer for the dead for their own parents. Mm-hmm. But in this period, there was definitely a gender bias. So yeah. Things have changed significantly.
Practices have changed. Yeah. So we have wandered a bit from what's in this chapter to what's in next chapter.
We have. But sorry, I think there's a lot to unpack in next chapter. And so it's definitely interesting to me that even though there's this whole kind of a quiet implication that the pennies are maybe being given out on the Sabbath, the shops aren't open.
Yes.
Right? They live in a Jewish neighborhood. They're about to go to the shop, and they can't go on Saturday because Saturdays is not a shopping day.
But Sunday, when the shops would be closed in a mostly Christian neighborhood because everyone is going to Sabbath services on Sunday,
yes.
In this neighborhood, the shops are open because I'm fairly sure, I could be wrong about this, I'm fairly sure that standard shops being open on Sunday is a relatively recent thing.
So the girls are about to go shopping.
And we meet a new character who I don't think returns.
No.
But I love him, Mr. Pincus.
Yes, Mr. Pincus is very vivid on the page. We get, you know, that he's bald, he has a big beard, and he has what Gertie calls a stomach what sticks out.
Mm-hmm.
So this is clearly a depiction of a large, bald, bearded, fat man, and he's got an accent. So this is very vividly drawn in a very quick burst of language. It's a little fat-shamey, which I don't love.
It's not really shamey very much. They don't laugh at him.
No.
For having a stomach what sticks out.
On the page.
And I do wonder if Gertie is saying he has a stomach what sticks out because she doesn't want to say he's fat.
Or possibly just because she's observing it, right? Like, that's how you describe someone. Like, he's, you know, which shopkeeper is it? Oh, that one. So we again get the sort of stereotypical Jewish old country accent as he's sort of bustling around his shop, trying to help the girls find the perfect present for Papa.
The phonetically rendered accent.
Yep, exactly. It's a little much in this day and age, but it gives us that color of the way that he says things. And some of the things he refers to, it's either like antiquated language or it's old country language. Or possibly just the language has shifted. Like, he suggests for Papa a pocketbook, which, you know, when you say pocketbook, I picture a purse. Mm-hmm. But I think what he actually means is like a little wallet.
I think so, too. Which, interestingly and ironically, wallet used to mean something much more like a purse.
Yes. And I looked it up, and 1910 wallets are starting to be kind of like modern wallets. You still have the coin purse, which, of course, persists to this day. But you also have the beginning of kind of the folding wallet. And some of them actually had a little a strap, like a tiny suitcase. So it sort of looked like you were taking a tiny suitcase out of your pocket. And I thought that was kind of fun. So it's possible that it's one of those. We don't really get a description. That gets rejected as being too expensive. We get a pocket knife, but Papa already has a knife. They hit on fancy garters for the shirt sleeves, right? The fancy garters that come in different colors, but they can't pick a color. I say, why not red to match the handkerchiefs? It's been established the handkerchiefs are red. Why not red garters? Maybe that's too flashy. I don't know. The tie, which is almost a winner, right? The tie costs 25 cents. They can afford it. But then there's the question of what do they do with the other 10 cents? You know, Henny's like, we're going to redistribute this money back to the girls and we're all going to go and get candy. Like, she's already got a plan in her head.
Yes.
Right. And all the other girls kind of shame her back into, no, this is to be spent on Papa.
No, that's too much for us. And it's too little to buy something else. It occurred to me at one point, why don't they want to buy Papa some candy? Does Papa not like candy?
I don't know whether it's that they think candy is for kids, because we certainly see the parents eating sweets at various points. But candy seems to be the domain of the children.
I think you're right. There's a perception that candy is for children, which is unfair. Adults should get to have candy.
Agreed. And I mean, maybe if they had seen like an expensive little box of like chocolates or something, they would have been like, oh, that's the thing. But I think it's also at this point, chocolate is equated with romance. And, you know, they're not going to buy a romantic gift for father. They're going to buy a dignified gift for father, you know. Because
yeah.
I really see the practicality in what they're doing. Like, it's interesting because they do ultimately land on something that's not super practical, but is fancy. They're trying to buy Papa something that he can use. This is the William Morris principle, right? Beautiful and functional.
Yes. Yeah, they don't want to be something that that something to eat will just be gone. If they want him to buy something that he can keep, admire, use.
Yes. And that will remind him that they love him.
Yes.
Which is, I think, the core of this piece of the story, is that we see the girls, we see their affection for Papa, we see Papa in his workplace, but now we get to see Papa at home, not on the Sabbath. Like, what can we give him that he can enjoy every day? Right? And so they don't buy the tie, for obvious reasons, and then the shirt is out of their price range. They can't afford a shirt, right? We don't even get a price for the shirt. So Mr. Pincus goes to all of this trouble. You know, the girls are having him schlep things up and down off the shelves. He's sweating, but he's not like, girls, you're making trouble for me. You know, girls, you're taking too long to decide. He's just continuing to present them with items, right? He's going to solve the problem.
He's taking them seriously as customers, and I love that.
Yes. Well, they're coming in with money and they're coming in with earnestness, and it doesn't look like anyone else is walking into the shop.
No, it doesn't talk about other customers. And, as will come up in a little bit, he knows their father.
Yes. So he definitely
has... This is a small neighborhood. It acts in its way like a small town. He knows who they are. He knows who their parents are. He's not going to be rude to the Brenner's children.
No. And also, like, they're there en masse. And the last thing he wants is to have crying girls in his shop.
Oh, good Lord, yes, that would be awful.
Right, like, imagine that he, you know, wasn't kind to them. And, you know, Gertie began crying. He probably doesn't know what to do with a crying kid. Or maybe he's got a ton of children and he's like, these are children. What if my children came into the shop? How would I want them to be treated? We don't have a picture of his family, but we get a sense that he's willing to treat with them as customers.
Yeah. And just, I point that out because I have seen both in real life and in a lot of other literature, adults just point blank refusing to take children seriously.
Yes.
Like, if there's anyone else in the shop, the adult gets the attention. The child has to wait no matter what order they came in. I just reread The Neverending Story, which begins, of course, with little 10-year-old Bastian stumbling into a bookshop and the shopkeeper telling him, I've got no use for children. I can't abide them. I don't have any children's books and I wouldn't sell you the other kind. Be off. Just utterly unwilling to engage with a child on any level except you are a pest, go away.
Right. I mean, it's really interesting that our generation has evolved to take my money as a rallying cry, right? Like, oh, you know, you want to do something awesome, take my money. And like, maybe it's sort of a retaliation against the idea that my money isn't good. Right? Like, because I'm a kid.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, my money will spend like anybody else's is a long-running thing in American history.
Exactly. And I think that that's something here. We've got a very small bit of children's rights. But the kids are confused at this point. They are really kind of floundering. And Ella says, we should have asked Charlie.
Yes.
So this is where we get...
Which is two things.
We get two things. Right, exactly. Go ahead.
As you said before, we get a reminder to the reader that Charlie exists, mm-hmm. and Charlie is Papa's best friend.
And would know Papa's tastes and what Papa wants.
And that's a guy we could have gotten. She doesn't say we should have asked Mama.
No.
They can't ask Mama. They're keeping it a secret for Mama.
But I mean, I feel like they'd be more willing to bring Mama in on the conspiracy if they thought that they were going to hit the stumbling block.
That's true. If they had considered that this would be a puzzler, they might have said, we could ask Mama what Papa thinks. But that's not what Ella thinks, and that's the second
thing.
No,
and that's what's really interesting.
We are reminded also, not just that Charlie exists, but that Ella has a little baby crush on him.
Ella has definitely impressed on Charlie, and we have this moment of like, oh, if we had just brought Charlie into the conspiracy. And I think that that's actually very attractive to Ella. Like, this sort of plays into the whole romantic fantasy of Ella and Charlie as compatriots, where she can just be like, Charlie, tell me what my father needs, right? Like, bringing him into the conspiracy is almost romantic. And that is the kind of crush idea.
Yeah, we don't get a lengthy fantasy sequence from Ella here, but you can imagine it.
Oh yeah, it's right there. It's just slightly off the page.
It's not on the page, but it's like hovering just behind the page.
Exactly. And so Ella, the oldest, is suddenly despairing, and Gertie, the youngest, immediately pipes up, what's that? Right?
Look at the pretty cup and saucer.
Right, yes. Exactly. And this is fascinating to me. Like, we've had multiple instances of Gertie can't read, right? In the first chapter about the library, Gertie can't read yet. She looks at the picture magazines. In the most recent chapter, she is being read to by Charlotte.
Because she can't read yet, yes.
Even though everyone else is reading silently. So clearly she's still not reading. And yet she still manages to pick out an item that has the word father on it. So is this just a very like subtle, hey, Gertie is learning to read? Or is it just like magical serendipity that she happens to pick out a father-specific item in this shop? Because it's up on a high shelf, so who knows if she can even see the words. Mm-hmm. But the shopkeeper brings this thing down. And I love the description of this because...
It's so lovely.
It's so lovely, but it's so ungendered. It's pink and white, right? It's gold. We don't, at this time, associate those colors with men. But at the time, pink for men was actually kind of a thing coming out of Victorian and Edwardian eras. More on the British side.
We hadn't yet,
We haven't gendered pink.
yeah, we had not yet got the very, very strong notion that pink is a girl color.
Right.
Because this is a mass marketed item. It's pink and white china and gold lettering on it. It says marched proudly uphill, I love that phrasing, to spell out the name father.
I'm trying to picture what that even looks like in terms of the letters marching proudly uphill, like whether they're kind of going up the side or whether they're like in a hill shape. I've never been able to really picture it, but clearly this is a designated item to buy for your dad.
I sort of picture it as on a left to right upwards diagonal, which is an odd choice, but sure, that's a good way to fit it on one side of the teacup where you can read the whole word at once.
That makes perfect sense, and I have definitely seen stuff like that, and even in the modern era, I think I have a cup from my cousin's bat mitzvah where it's like logoed on one side, and it's a stylized dancer, and she's kind of got one leg up in the air, so she fits on the side of the cup.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, and I mean, this is clearly a somewhat luxury item, and Mr. Pinchas takes it off the shelf and is like, "Wait, wait, it's even more perfect because he does know their father. Your dad has a mustache."
And it's got the little mustache guard that he points out to them.
And so it's just an interesting idea. Like, here is a man's cup, right? You know, in its beautiful pink and gold beauty, a man's cup that holds the mustache. And it's practical. So the girls are like, beautiful and practical. Papa will love it.
Exactly what they want. And like you said, this is a luxury item, but like, let's be clear, this is a bargain store luxury item.
Yes.
This is not something that they would get at a boutique where rich people shop for other rich people. You
Yes.
are not going to get this pretty pink and white and gold leaf or gold painted China world's best dad mug.
No. And I mean, that is effectively what it is. Like, this is kind of the equivalent of like a Woolworths or a dollar store at a very small scale.
But for their context, this is, as you say, a luxury item. It has no purpose but to be pretty, to be pleasant, it's to drink tea out of. But you can
Yes.
drink tea out of anything.
Right, and that is exactly what happens, is they bring home this lustrous, beautiful object, and they present it to Papa in the most ornate way that they can, which is that they wrap it and they place it as his place at the table. Papa comes in, and the narration is omniscient, and it gives us the reality that Papa has had a bad day. Right? He has had a difficult day. He's exhausted. He just wants to eat supper.
Long, hard day, not a very profitable one. It says there's very little business done,
Right.
and he's just exhausted and dispirited. He's in poor spirits.
Right. And I mean, also, like the emotional exhaustion of being the money maker, right? And so now we have this expectations mismatch at the extreme, where the girls are like vibrating with excitement, and Papa comes in, he's dragging himself up the stairs, he's washing. But Mama's like, supper is ready. The girls rush to the kitchen because they want to see Papa's reaction to the reality of the gift, not what it is, but that it exists.
That they got him a present.
And Papa is surprised.
Completely.
You know, he's just like, oh my God, the girls are getting me a present. How does this work? And it's really interesting because he absolutely does not expect it. Like, he loves that they remember his birthday. And that's exciting. Like, it's always great when someone remembers your birthday. But he doesn't expect this additional level of devotion because they're small girls, right? Ella is 12, right? She is not going to have a bat mitzvah because we don't have bat mitzvahs in this period where, you know, she's confirmed as being a woman in the eyes of Judaism. That doesn't happen for another 40 years, longer, I think. So we don't have that ticking over into womanhood. And so as a result, the idea of his daughter as the ringleader of a, you know, let's get Papa a present scheme doesn't occur to him. And so here are the girls. They've presented Papa with a present, and Papa goes, oh no, what is happening?
Because he couldn't quite believe it. He's just turning over the wrapped package in his
And the
hands.
girls are like, aren't you going to open it? Like, it's a present. And it's really interesting because this is very child perspective versus parent perspective, because the adult enjoyment of a gift is the anticipation. It may not be what's in the package, but the fact that you got me a present is in some ways more important than the fact of what it is.
What it is barely matters at all. He is still processing. They got me a present.
Right. My girls got me a present. Like, they're old enough to do this. Like, oh my God, am I missing their childhoods? That doesn't go on the page,
Oh,
but it's
no,
kind of
that's not on the
there.
page, but this is a kind of a life-changing thing in a way, or life-changing is not the right word.
But it is a change of life thing, right? Like, my girls are getting older, is the realization.
That's what I was trying to say. Yeah, this is an indication. This is a signpost.
Of the passage of time.
Life has changed when I wasn't looking. My
Exactly.
little baby girls are old enough to do this for themselves, for me.
Yes, exactly. It's not like Mama bought the present and said it was from the girls. The girls bought the present. And Mama is very clear on that.
Oh yes, a present from your daughters, she says.
Right. She might not even know what it is.
We don't get much of a sense of how Mama feels about it.
We don't. In fact, Mama is elided almost entirely from this chapter.
Yeah.
It's a very Papa focused chapter, and we do get that, like, sort of the Mama focus, Papa focus shifting a lot as we go through chapter to chapter. We don't get Mama's interiority at all. We don't get Mama helped us wrap the present. We don't get Mama gave us paper to wrap the
No, I
present.
think actually Mr. Pincus is the one who wraps the present.
Right. So we effectively have this mystery package. So Mama is almost disavowing it because she doesn't know what's inside.
Right? Says, nope, your girls did this.
Right. And good
And
or
there's that way
bad,
that parents sometimes have of
your
saying
daughter,
your children instead
yes,
of our children.
your child came home with the mud pie.
There's different reasons you would do that, and it's often framed as like, oh, I had nothing to do with this. I am in a way blaming you for what your kids did.
Your genetics are responsible.
But in this case, I think it's less, oh, this was something that I'm mad about, and so I'm disavowing it. It was, this is something that I want to give all the credit to our girls. So I'm not even going to say our daughters. I'm going to say your daughters who love you bought you this present.
Right.
I feel like Mama's pleased,
I think so too,
but also
but
like
maybe a little surprised.
holding back that this, she wants to make clear that she didn't do this.
Right.
She didn't organize this. This was all them.
And I mean, we definitely get that continuing in, subsequent chapters where the girls start to do things. We're seeing them age up and become, if not adults, at least more confident children. And so here is the present. The presentation of the present is quick, right? Like, here's the present, open it, open it. And Papa's like, wait, a present. Oh my goodness. So he does open it. And then we get the interiority crashing down. Papa is surprised, but he's like, oh no, they spent money on this?
Yes, that the first hint we get of how they feel is, how he feels is the children going, "What made Papa's face look so sorrowful?"
Right.
Like just that he's sad, and then we get Papa is thinking, so much money spent in a fancy cup and saucer that I could just as well do
Right.
without. Don't we have enough cups and saucers? I have to work so hard to make money for the things that we need. And what if the amount they spent wouldn't help much? It's little spendings like this that add up. It's hurting him
It is. It's
that
hurting him that.
money that could have gone for something they need went for something A, just for him, B, that he doesn't need at all. We have cups.
But the interesting thing is that that is their pin money,
Yeah.
right? And so it would have gotten spent on candy, or it would have gotten spent on a doll.
If it had gotten spent on candy or dolls, exactly, it wouldn't have. This was not money that was part of the household budget.
Well, it's interesting because it is part of the household budget. It's part of the budget that goes to giving the kids joy.
Yes.
And Papa realizes that the equation is altered, right? He's taken joy out of his children's lives, and they have given the joy to him. And now he realizes that he has a way to give the joy back, and that is to lie.
Yeah.
So Papa tells the gentlest of lies, and he tells the
Yes.
girls how much he loves the cup, and in fact, a bigger lie, which is that he's always wanted something like this.
Yes, that's the great thing. Not just, oh, what a lovely surprise, but I've wanted something like this for so long. How
Right.
did you think of it?
Right,
And
and
that's.
it's a redemption of the bad feeling. Like, he says he was in shock because they found the thing that he'd always wanted. And that is a fascinating lie. Or maybe it's rooted in truth. Maybe he really did want something, fun and silly.
A little fancy.
Right, because I mean, this is Morris Brenner. Morris Brenner is an artist. And while we don't see a lot of that on the page, if you read From Sarah to Sydney, you definitely get this picture of teenage Morris Brenner doing incredibly elaborate paper cuts. And paper cuts is an art style. It's not something you get on your hand after you handle too much paper in Papa's shop. It is incredibly elaborate, and just absolutely gorgeous. And he does this huge, like, beautiful ritual paper cut when he turns 13. And so this is a man with the soul of an artist. He might be cringing looking at this cup. He might think, oh, this is a mass-produced,
He might
tchotchke.
think it's tacky,
Right.
or as you say, he might really think it's pretty.
Exactly. Like, we don't know.
But he can't let himself enjoy owning something beautiful that he can't justify economically. The only way he can let himself accept this is by thinking of it as it would be cruel to deny the girls the pleasure of giving me a present.
I mean, it's interesting because similar to what we see with Mr. Pincus, Pop could tell the girls to take it back. It would be completely out of character, but like, we don't have a lot of Papa's character at this point. This is an establishing moment for the story of who Papa is, right? And Papa chooses to be kind. We absolutely could have had a situation where Papa's like, no girls, I can't, we can't afford this, take it back to the shop.
And that could have been done in so many ways, too. He could have been angry.
Absolutely.
He could have been, oh, I love you all so much. This is such a good thought. I'm so sorry to tell you we can't afford this. You have to take it back.
But it's also funny because they can afford it. And maybe that's the other
They
realization.
can. They did. They afforded it. They
Right.
took the money that was for pleasure and frivolity, which kids are allowed to have. They have enough money for the kids to do that.
Which he and Mama have been carving out of their savings or whatever
Exactly, all this time.
all this time to make sure that they have that joy budget.
But the moment that that comes back to Papa, he's like, no, I shouldn't have this. This isn't practical.
I don't deserve it.
I think I don't deserve it might be a bit of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's just such a crushing moment of like, why is this being lavished on me? And like, he's literally dragging himself up the stairs. He's literally washing oil out from his hands. He is emotionally and physically exhausted to the point where a beautiful gesture is a shock.
And it hurts.
It does. It really hurts Papa. And he turns it around on a dime. And I mean, that really is, I think Ella gets her theatricality maybe a little bit from her father,
Ha.
right?
Oh, I never thought of that, but you're right. Just the ability to turn this into, okay, no, I have to give this to them. I have to make sure that they feel good about getting me a present because that's all they wanted. And then he just throws himself into, this is so wonderful. I was speechless with delight. Mama, pour me a cup of coffee right now. I can't wait to use my beautiful present.
Coffee at 6 p.m. Right? He's gonna be up all night.
Coffee in the evening is not
Okay,
unusual,
fair.
though. Coffee in the evening was
It
not
might actually perk
unusual,
him up
but.
too, which is probably something that he desperately needs right now. But moreover, this little performance, this little improv that he does is immediately rewarded. His audience goes wild. The girls are hugging and kissing him. He is swarmed by girls, and that is the episode end. That's where we leave the scene. The girls are swarming Papa and kissing and hugging him to the point where he can't keep track of who is
Yes.
everywhere, right? Like, oh, look, all my girls, right? And it's an amazing spot to be because
There's so much love in this room.
exactly the joy circle is like a circuit. It's completed because they've given him something and he's given them something, which is his real gratitude, not for the thing that they got him, but for the thing that they did. And he is able to accept it for that reason. I really, really wonder if Papa continues to use the mug.
I would hope so.
But I do think it's really interesting how democratic the girls are, because it is Gertie who kind of saves the day. And I mean, it's interesting because a lot of the motivation in these chapters kind of comes from, Ella or Sarah and, very occasionally Henny, and sometimes even Charlotte. But Gertie tends to be the one who's like, I'm observing, I'm observing. Hey, wait a minute.
Gertie is mostly the follower, but this time she is the one who points out the thing that I do agree that the girls are awfully democratic. There's not very much bossing.
No.
There is, okay, we're all gathering for a meeting and we're all going to agree on something before we go ahead with it.
Yes.
Rather than Ella saying, here's what we're going to do, and you all have to listen to me because I'm the oldest.
Right, which is totally, it wouldn't be in character for her, at least not as she's set up in these stories.
For her, no. It's a thing that happens in other fictional and real families, that the older siblings feel very much that it is their job to be the boss.
Oh, absolutely. And maybe if Charlotte had been the oldest, but like.
You know what? Possibly if Charlotte had been the oldest, she would very much feel it her job to be the boss.
But I also get a really strong sense of consent, right? Like Gertie and Charlotte have this relationship where Charlotte makes the rules and Gertie follows them. But if Gertie were to earnestly say to Charlotte, I don't want to do this, Charlotte would say, okay, then we won't do it.
Probably.
Like if Gertie chose to opt out in the middle, I don't think Charlotte would be like, no, Gertie, you're doing it because I say so.
I think you're right. I think if Gertie were to say, no, this isn't fun, Charlotte wouldn't say, but you gotta, it's the rule, or you have to do it because I say so, or if you don't, I won't play with you anymore.
Right. I don't see that on the page.
There's nothing to indicate that that's a facet of their relationship.
Yeah. Obviously, these are idealized pictures of these people
Well,
because
sure.
obviously based on the real Brenner sisters, but in the book, definitely there's more of a consent between the two of them. Like it's almost like a little bargain, right? I'll make the rules and you'll follow the rules, but it has to be fun. You know, we'll stop doing it when it stops being fun is a really good rule.
It's a good rule in anything.
Exactly.
And Henny likes very much to go her own way. She doesn't like to take orders. She also doesn't like to give orders. That's not her deal mostly.
Yeah.
We do see a little bit more of Henny the organizer in the later books.
Yes, definitely. But Henny organizes, but she's not bossy about it. She can be a little bit dictatorial, but it's more of a, you know, if we do it my way, I have a plan.
Yeah, it's like if we do it my way, this will work. And there's also I can already tell everybody here wants to do this. I have an idea for how we can do it.
Right, exactly.
Henny is a leader, but seldom a dictator.
This is a really just beautiful little chapter. And, you know, like the cup, it's kind of a luxury, right? Like we just have this little moment of joy in the family that is entirely manufactured, right? Like if they hadn't gotten Papa a gift, he would have had a gloomy birthday. If Papa hadn't accepted the gift, it would have been a sad day, the time that Papa didn't take the birthday present, right?
If they had decided, oh, we're just going to use our school supplies and make Papa a card or a sign that says, Happy Birthday, Papa, it would have been very pleasant. I'm sure it would have been nice. It would have maybe brightened his day a little bit, but it wouldn't have
Maybe
been.
not memorable.
And this chapter is, in a way that very few of the preceding chapters have been, except a little bit the first one. This chapter is about money and about not having it.
Exactly. And it's a very nice way of saying it too.
Yes.
It is a gentle way of reminding the audience that money is still a really big concern. They're still paying off the library book all these months later, and that makes daily financing a little bit tight.
And Papa works really hard for really very little money and worries about it. And he's like, the kids are not consciously aware that the necessary things in their house are like that there's a very thin margin between do we have enough to eat and do we not.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's just not part of their regular consciousness because their parents work hard to make sure it won't be.
Exactly. And I mean, the girls are being raised in a middle class mindset in a poor household.
In a big way,
And that's something I really relate to. Like growing up, we absolutely had hand-me-downs. We absolutely had, you know, canned food and food that was in the freezer and whatever. And part of that was the reality of growing up away from kosher food, but keeping kosher. But a large part of it was that, you know, we were a one salary household until we were, you know, well into my childhood. And so that reality of dressing well and presenting well while not having a lot of resources is a reality for me. And I definitely resonated with that growing up. So, you know, the idea of having your pennies to spend, for me, it was at the drugstore. I would go and I actually still have like a little China cat that I bought when I was about 7 and started getting an allowance. And just recently, a friend of mine came with his 2-year-old and they were at our house and she picked it up and she just played with it and had a really wonderful time. And I was like amazed, A, that she could handle China without dropping it, but also that she gravitated to it the same way I did when I was a little girl.
That's so delightful. I love that. I know that when we were growing up, we were not hurting for money, but we definitely had to be aware of it. And when I say we, I mean my parents, because similarly, they did a lot to make sure that we did not feel like we were poor. We weren't poor, but we had to be careful, I think, is possibly the best way of looking at it.
Exactly.
We did not have large amounts of money for casual expenditures. And one of the things I remember not really getting until much, 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 much later was there was a period of time when we didn't have meat in the chelent on Shabbos. For those of you who don't know, chelent is a very common Shabbat food. It is a slow-cooked dish with usually meat and or bones, most often potatoes, beans, barley. Immense, immense amounts of variation in that. You put it up on a very low heat Friday before Sabbath begins, and you eat it for lunch the next day. This goes back to long before there were slow cookers or electric cookers at all. One of the most common ways they used to do this in ancient times was everybody would bring their own personal pot to the village bakehouse, where the fires never went out. And then everybody would have their pot marked with their own family name so that you wouldn't accidentally take home someone else's chelent.
And our current name for chillin actually comes from French, because chaud is hot and lent is slowly, lentement, right? Slowly. And so you have chaud, lent, slow, hot.
Chelent, yes. Yeah, that is one theory of the etymology, and I think the strongest one.
It's pretty strong. I mean, it's clearly not the only name that this dish has had.
Yes, I believe one of the Sephardic names for it is hamin, which comes from the Hebrew ham, which is hot. I don't know what the min suffix means. It might just mean thing that is hot. Hot dish, basically. But it might have a specific meaning, I'm not sure.
I feel like mean actually has a specific meaning, and I'm going to have to look that up and put it in the show notes.
Yeah. But in any case, we usually had meat in the chillin', and then for a long time we didn't. I say a long time. I was like 8. I don't know how long it was. It could have been only a month or two, and it's in my brain as a long time because a month or two is an incredibly long time when you're 8, as I said earlier.
Absolutely.
But it did not occur to me until years and years and years later. Oh, was that because we couldn't afford beef? I bet it was. And I talked to my parents, and they said, we were trying to cut down on spending that during that time.
Right, exactly. And I mean, there are little things that, especially because Shabbat is so ritualized, as we really talked about in the last chapter, there are so many little rituals that we do that are every week we have the same whatever, so that you would notice if the meat was missing.
We'd notice a change, yeah.
Exactly. So that's something that I think Mama and Papa are very, very much trying for the consistency so that the girls don't feel like things are missing. And I think Papa's, I would honestly call it guilt
Guilt is not a bad word for it,
over
yeah.
the idea that the girls are spending, feels bad about it, right? The girls are spending their joy money on me. How do I rectify the situation? And it's also like he doesn't say, oh, this has got to be a one-time thing, girls. You may never get me a birthday present again. Like he doesn't do
Right,
that.
right. He does not want them to feel poor, I think is a big part of that. And he doesn't do what so many people would do, which is lash out because he feels bad.
Right, exactly. Instead, he pulls it in.
He pulls it in and he transforms it.
And that is really like Sydney's love for her father really shines on this page. Like, this
So
is, I love
much.
my father so much. Now, this could be fictional. We don't know that this really happened, but like, the feeling we get from the chapter is the girls love Papa. Papa is, to some degree, their hero, right? Like, he is the one who does the work so they can play. And he is just constantly focused on their happiness. And this is really kind of like a one-time thing where they're like, we really need to make Papa happy. And we have the social contract, obviously. We're
We
being
do.
good girls, we do our chores, what have you. But that is in many ways a contract with Mama.
True, because the home belongs to Mama.
And so it's when they go and help Papa at the shop that they show love. So this is the first time we get a callback to that since we saw the chapter with the books. Papa has rewarded them with books that he could otherwise have made money off of.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not like he hasn't given them presents on the page. Right? We've seen this like explicitly, like here, I'm taking this out of my own pocket and giving it to you on top of your money that you get. And now he feels bad that they got him one cup and saucer. So the unfairness of that is definitely sort of in my head of like, well, of course they're giving you a present. You deserve it.
Right. And I feel like the key word in a way here for Papa's whole everything this chapter is gentle.
Yes, definitely. Papa's
His
sweetness.
smile is described in that second to last. Papa smiled his wide, gentle smile.
Exactly. And that's, I think that's where we leave it, right? Like Papa has blessed the lives of his girls with his joy.
And with his gentleness. And the sadness he is able to turn around and say to his children, "No, of course I'm not sad. You have made me so happy."
Yeah, and I mean, it's my friend says, my friend has this phrase, good mood by force of will.
Oh, that's a good phrase.
And I think that that's such a useful concept in modern life because, okay, I have to get up, I have to go to work, everything is awful, my thermos exploded, I can't handle it. Good mood by force of will. I'm going to find a way to be happy, and I'm going to find a way to put that happiness into my environment so my bad day does not redouble on everyone around me. And I mean, it's actually like a lot of cognitive load to do that. But he's surrounded by joy. And it's a lot easier to keep joy in yourself, even if it's false joy, when real joy surrounds you. So by borrowing the girl's joy, he is able to keep the situation from teetering into something melodramatic and sad.
Yes, it's let them enjoy this thing, and because he said let them enjoy this thing and gave that to them, it comes back to him and he gets
He
to.
gets to enjoy it too.
Even though I think, like, we are not back in his head at the end, we don't know if he was, like, really buoyed up by that or if he was just faking it for the rest of dinner and inside feeling just sad and having to hide it. But I think it's likely that even if he didn't stop being sad, he was also joyful. Because you could do both at the same time. You can do both at the same time.
Yeah, and I think that that's again very Jewish, right?
Very Jewish.
You know, sadness and joy together. So I think that that nicely covers Papa's birthday.
I think so. That's about it for this chapter. Let's see, a little piece of the home.
I will definitely want to come back to this when we do chapter illustrations because the black and white illustration that I have in my book is of someone brushing her hair. And I literally can't tell which daughter it's supposed to be, and it's attached to this, and I don't understand why, and I've never understood why, and it bothers me.
Oh gosh, you're right. That the very first the chapter heading, I'm pretty sure that's supposed to be Ella brushing her hair, but I'm not sure why Ella brushing her hair is attached to this chapter.
I think they just had an extra illustration left over,
Could be.
honestly. Like, it should be the girls in the shop or something, or just a picture of the present on the table. Like, that
Yeah.
would be much more iconic for this chapter. But we'll talk about that when we talk about illustrations.
Yes. So for now, we're wrapping up. I'm Batya Wittenberg.
And I'm Mira Hoffman, and we're really glad that you're here.
So tune in next time when we'll hear Mama say, "Henny, I don't think all that bouncing is good for the bedspring." Our opening theme music is the public domain Dill Pickle Rat, performed here by Arthur Pryor's band, courtesy of the Internet Archive. Our closing theme music is the La Sirène Waltz, also in the public domain, written by Pietro Dero, performed here by Daniel Gunderson and Sonny Larson. All of a Kind Podcast's logo is by Al Benbow. Please see our full production credits on our website at allofakindpodcast.com.